Well, it's good to see everyone here today. Good to have our visitor here. Good to have you all here. This beautiful September morning, with all the moisture we've had, just been change of the temperatures. Just a wonderful time of the year, it seems to me, and we're grateful to God for it. When you got up this morning, or after you ate breakfast, did you wash? Have you washed several times this morning? Will you wash several times before you go to bed tonight? It's an important part of our lives, and over the years, you know, as you read perhaps in your junior high science course, people got in history to the point where they began to recognize something about germs. And they began to adjust to the knowledge of the fact that germs need to be washed off. Germs spread disease. Germs make us unhealthy. It's an interesting study in history at that point of your life, science, that it finally was catching up to great need. In Scripture, God didn't always explain why He said things. But in Leviticus 10 and verse 10, He made it clear that in Israel, He wanted there to be a clear distinction between the clean and the unclean. The clean and the unclean. Whether it was the food that He would allow them or not allow them to have, or whether it was their person, which somehow in the judgment of God became contaminated by some experience or event or circumstance. And He would give various sacrifices, required sacrifices. Maybe a period of time was rendered before, after contamination, that person would be legally and socially declared clean again. If you touch the body of a corpse at a funeral, you're unclean. If a woman had a baby, she was unclean. There are all kinds of things that rendered a person unclean. Didn't mean he was committing sin. That wasn't the point. But God was making a distinction. There is, in my judgment, and for Israel, a distinction between what's dirty and what's not. And in the camp of Israel, since that was the specified location, in a sense, the localized presence of God by the tabernacle, and then later by the temple, God was saying, in effect, where My presence is being considered localized, you must be clean. Now, there were other sacrifices that had to do with their sins. And of course, that was very, very important. But if they violated the cleanliness ordinances, they were committing sin. Now, isn't that interesting? And so, down to our point in time, we've kind of gotten hold of the expressions, cleanliness is next to godliness. Well, there's a reason for that kind of expression. And when you come to the Bible, you can find these great lessons that God is trying to help us to understand by the discussion of righteousness from the viewpoint of cleanliness. And I want us to make some of those points this morning. So the title of the lesson is, Have You Washed? Have you washed? And I want us to come to 1 Kings 22. And I want us to make a point that we don't usually make here. The context of this is that Israel's king is Ahab, a horrible individual. And in Judah, Jehoshaphat is on the throne. And there had been war between the northern tribe of Israel and Ahab in Syria for a while, but there had been peace for several years. Ahab decides that he wants to recover a town that they had lost in the war, Ramoth-Gilead. And Jehoshaphat, having made a visit to Ahab, is asked if he would be an ally. Ahab wants to know, can we go together and fight and get back our territory in Ramoth-Gilead? Jehoshaphat says, that's fine. We'll go with you. We'll fight the war with you. And we're not going through all the details of that right now, as we have done that in the past. But during that war, Ahab is killed. And so, let's pick it up in verse 37. So the king died, and was brought to Samaria. And they buried the king in Samaria. And one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria. The first point on my outline in this sermon is, have you washed your chariot and armor? Have you washed your chariot and armor? And one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now the harlots washed themselves there. And they washed his armor, according unto the word of the Lord which he spake. Now this is back in chapter 21, verse 19, this prophecy was given. Now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did, and the ivory house which he made, and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, the prophecy was made. God had used a prophet to make this prediction. That's what's going to happen. Dogs are going to lick up your blood. And it didn't last. I mean, the prophecy was short made before it was fulfilled. But then when they bring their chariot there to this particular place and they wash it out, washing the blood out. And then they take his armor and they wash blood off of the armor that he had lost, the blood that he had lost in the fight with Syria. Now, I want to look at that this morning from this viewpoint. Have you washed your chariot and have you washed your armor? The next one that used that had to use it, and it needed to be ready. Ahaziah, his son, we're not told if he got into the chariot, he was the next one that owned it, but he might have been if it was the king's chariot. We're not told if Ahab's armor was the very exact piece of armor that Ahaziah used. We're not told that. But it may well have been. I'm simply asking the question, are you keeping your chariot? Are you keeping your armor fit? Is it washed? Is it ready for the next encounter with the enemy? Whatever it is. You come to the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 and following, and there you'll have one of the passages that outlines for us the armor of the Christian as he goes to war and fighting Satan, the devil, false doctrine, everything that's wrong out there. What about your armor, the shield of faith? What about your helmet, the helmet of salvation? What about the sword of the Spirit? What about the shoes on your feet, the preparation of God? What about your faith? And he uses, I mean, your prayer life at the end of that, with all things praying. Is everything in order for you to pick up and go to the next battle? Now, as I say, I don't know if Ahaziah was the next one to use it. Somebody, I would assume, used it. Somebody would pick it up. When do you get through with fighting? Well, when do you get through living? When do you get through resisting temptation? When do you get through with the devil? Well, when do you die? Keep your armor. Keep your equipment in your personal life. I'm talking about you do it with you, and I've got to do it with me. But I need to have a clean chariot. I need to have a clean armor. I need to have a sharp sword. I need to have equipment that serves me well. You remember when David would not take the armor from Saul? He said, I'll just use this sling. That's what had served him well. But you have to keep that in order. What if he had gone to fight with a broken sling? What if he couldn't find any stones? Isn't it wonderful that on the scene of battle there was no panic? When I deal with the devil, when I deal with false doctrine, when I deal with sin, there should be no panic. The equipment should be right. I must understand how to use it. And I must use it with wisdom and judgment and with courage. Wash out the chariot. Wash off the armor. Make sure all is ready. Number two, have you washed your hands? Have you washed your hands? And I want us, first of all, to look at Mark chapter 7 in the New Testament, in verse 1. In Mark chapter 7, in verse 1, and there gathered together unto him the Pharisees and certain of the scribes who had come to Jerusalem and had seen that some of his disciples ate their bread with defile, that is, unwashing hands. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands diligently, eat not, holding the tradition of the elders. Now, a point of clarification. There was no law in Israel that you had to wash your hands every time you ate. That was not there. This is one of those cases where the Pharisees have overdone the law. They've made up a law for God. And so, Jesus was not necessarily going to hold to their traditions. And when they come from the marketplace, except they bathe themselves, they eat not. And many other things there are, which they have received to hold, washings of cups and pots and brazen vessels. And the Pharisees and the scribes ask him, that is, they ask Jesus, "Why walk not thy disciples according to the tradition of the elders, but eat their bread with defiled hands?" And then he gets on them because by their traditions they violate the law of God. But I simply want us to make the point that it's good, spiritually speaking, to wash your hands. How do I know? James will tell me that. James chapter 4, verse 8. You need to wash your hands, you sinners. Members of the church that have gone off into some sort of heresy or developed some sort of a contentious disposition. Why are you warring with each other? Why are you fighting among yourselves? And he gets on them about that. He says, you need to clean up your hearts. You need to purify your hearts. And you need to cleanse your hands. And so, spiritually speaking, he makes application of the fact that we need to make sure that we are not dirty in the eyes of God. You know, you're using your hands all the time. You get to where you lose one or you can't use one, you know, you realize how you just every day you take it for granted. But my hands, spiritually speaking, little children are taught these lessons, you know, to use your eyes and your ears and your hands in the service of God. You know, be careful what you do with your hands. Be careful what you do with your feet and your eyes. And all kids by the thousands have been taught those kinds of lessons over the years. My hands are for the service of Christ. So James says, you need to purify your hearts. You need to cleanse your hands. You're acting like sinners. In fact, you have become sinners again. And you don't want to do that. But Matthew 27:24 tells us that it's possible for a fella to get the wrong idea. And you can use some symbolism that does not cover your dirt. Do you remember, and you do, when Jesus was on trial for His life and when Pilate desperately wanted to turn Him loose? But political pressure was exerted. And so he decided, I've got to cave in. I've got to give the Jews what they want. What did he do? He took him some sort of a bowl and he washed his hands. And why did he do that? Now he understood the difference between the physical and the political. But by the physical, he wanted to indicate where he ought to stand in political history. Where he should stand. How's that? I want it clear on the historical record that I am clean from the death of this man. Now, he wasn't. So, I understand that you can understand the lesson about the difference between dirt and clean, being dirty and clean. And you can misapply a point. You may wash your hands and declare yourself innocent, and God says you're still guilty. Most religious people are there. They have gone through some form or mode of what they call baptism and declare themselves clean. I want it understood, just like Pilate said, I want it understood that I am clean. And yet, biblical history, as it was, shows understanding of the history shows that they're not clean. Now there's a lesson there. You know, some words even get ingrained in mind so much. When people will talk about, I was baptized when I was a baby. How does that work? I mean, the words themselves get so distorted in a culture, in a society, that people are using words and concepts in such distorted fashion, they have no idea that the dirt is still there. Have you washed your hands in a real sense? Number three, have you washed your feet? You know, I find this interesting in John 13 when Jesus did something very unusual. And you start thinking about what we've read in Genesis with regard to feet. Have you washed your feet? You know, in modern times, in America, that became a point of contention. Foot washing. Should we have foot washing? Is that a part of the pattern of New Testament Christianity? And there are groups that practice foot washing. Gus Nichols had one of those debates in the 1940s, which is very good, on this matter of foot washing. Is it a part of worship or not? But you know, Jesus did a very unusual thing in John 13 that you don't find in the book of Genesis, and as far as I can remember, throughout Old Testament history. When we come to Genesis 24 and other passages, Genesis 18, we'll see Abraham, or we'll see Laban and Bethuel. We'll see those people providing water so that a man that's come on a journey can wash his own feet. Now think about that. If you were living in that time and you had been on the road all day and wore sandals and you were in a desert-like environment and somebody provided you water, you'd be glad to take that good water and wash your feet. You said, that's nice. I appreciate that. And that's what you see in Genesis. The water was provided for the person to wash his own feet. But in John 13, that's not what Jesus does. In John 13, He lowers Himself to the level of washing somebody else's feet. And it's not for show. And it's not a part of a worship service. It's a demonstration of absolute humility and subjecting yourselves to the needs of others. You've got to see yourself as a servant on this earth. The Son of Man came not to be ministered to, but to minister, and to give His life a ransom for many. And so, don't be, you know, as they sometimes want to do, which is the greatest among us? Jesus says the greatest one is the greatest server. The one who humbles himself and serves. And so, unlike what we find in the Old Testament, Jesus comes along and changes the event. I don't know that we've often thought about that comparison enough. I am going to wash your feet. And Peter was bothered by it. Peter said, no, not so, Lord. You're not going to wash my feet. Well, that's just not appropriate. And Jesus says, well, then you have nothing to do with me. Well, then he says, well, that's going to be the fallout. Just bathe me all over. And Jesus says, that's not required. Peter always had some comeback, didn't he? Peter always had something to say. But sometimes he was wrong about that. He was impetuous. He was rash in his speech. But have you washed your feet? Luke 7:38, you had that case of the woman who washed his feet with the tears that she was crying. And she anointed his feet with oil. With her hair. And wiped them with her hair. Just an amazing thing. Have you washed your feet? Number four, have you washed your face? Have you washed your face? Matthew 6:17, Jesus is talking about the need of private personal devotion to God. He had to deal with this because of the way that things sometimes looked in society and the way that the Pharisees presented things. But in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 17, he says, now when you fast, wash your face. Wash your face. The Pharisees wanted their piety to be easily recognized. And in a sense, you could say, on display. As they walked among the rank and file of the Jews, they liked to have the appearance of superiority. I think that's one of the things what has bothered us as Christians. When we look around at denominations and we have seen the way that denominational preachers have adopted the term reverend, you know, and that's kind of mild compared to other things. Some groups, you know, they'll take on the title of worshipful master, or you'll have somebody being identified in the Catholic Church as father. I've been around one or two of those. And wearing some sort of a garb. Now, not every group does this, but often you'll have the collar or the robe or the name or the identification, something that makes them stand out as holier or superior or different from everybody else. Now you get down here to this lower rung, you say, well, reverend, we don't mean anything by that. Well, why use it? Well, the robe. Well, I wanted to identify me as a preacher. Why have that like that? Jesus discusses the principle. But the Pharisee wanted to be recognized as superior. And he wanted to put his religion on display. And so Jesus will come along and say, now when you fast, other people don't need to know about that. Oh yes, oh you don't know how much I've been suffering. I've been fasting for 10 days now. Oh, seeing somebody might want to be thinking like, God bless you, brother, whatever. Oh, that's wonderful. Putting our religion on display like that, God says, that's no good. That's no good. You may make yourselves look wonderful and superior to everybody else who doesn't know your heart, but God says, we know your heart. So why are you fasting? Are you fasting to be seen of men? That's what Jesus said. They do that. They pray to be seen of men. Instead of basically to have prayers answered, they're in the business of praying so that somebody else will glorify them. But Jesus would teach us all, let your works be done among men that others may see them and glorify the Father. So the whole thing was misguided. So in our illustration regarding the face, it has to do with personal experiences. Trying to make sure that your experiences are for truth and with truth and of truth, and you're not trying to put yourself on display. Number 5, have you washed your eyes? The last part of John 9, verses 35 through 41, this becomes a very clear thing. Jesus had just healed a blind man, blind from birth. And at the end of John chapter 9, you know, there's a discussion about that. Jesus heard that they'd cast him out, the blind man. He loses some privileges. And finding him, he said, dost thou believe on the Son of God? He answered and said, and who is he, Lord, that I may believe on him? Jesus said unto him, thou hast both seen him, and he it is that speaketh with thee. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. And Jesus said, for judgment came I into this world, that they that see not may see, and that they that see may become blind. Now watch it. Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said unto him, are we also blind? Jesus said unto them, if ye were blind, ye would have no sin. But you say, we see, your sin remains. Earlier he had told that physically blind man, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And he went, and he washed, and he came forth seeing. And so the Pharisees saying, are you saying that we're blind? Yes, you are. Because you don't see the sin you're in. You like the superior position. You like to be teachers in Israel. You're a bunch of hypocrites practicing sin, making laws up for God. You don't see how wrong you are. Have you washed your eyes? Have you anointed your eyes? Revelation 3:18, the church at Laodicea was told to buy some salve and anoint their eyes. They needed to see, and they could not see as things were. Job 31:1, Job once made the observation that he made a covenant with his eyes. He made a covenant with his eyes. You don't want to go through life, and in the context of that, why then should I look upon a maiden? In other words, he's not being drawn away to other women by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye. I made a covenant with my eyes, he said. Have you washed your eyes? Have you cleaned your eyes? Number six, have you washed the whole body? You say it like this. 2 Kings 5:10, an Old Testament illustration. Captain of the host of Syria, Naaman, was a mighty man, but he was a leper. And he had gotten word that there wasn't somebody in Israel that could help him. And he goes over there, and without going through the details of the whole story, here he comes with all this money to pay whoever it is that can heal him. And first he goes to the king, but the king can't help him. And Elisha hears about him, and says, "Send him to me, and he'll know there's a prophet in Israel." And so Naaman makes his way down to where Elisha lived, but Elisha doesn't come out. Send his servant out, go wash 7 times in the Jordan. And he got angry. Like a lot of religious people do, when we find out there's something wrong with us. Instead of wanting the improvement and wanting the correction, we just want to go away in a rage. And that's what he did. And his servants got it to him and said, "Now, Master, if the prophet had said to do some great thing, you would have done it. Why not this small thing?" And so he went and he dipped his whole body in the Jordan River 7 times, and he came up, and his flesh was like that of a little baby. In the New Testament, the baptism water that is used in baptism is always associated with forgiveness of sins. Hebrews 10:22 is a good passage on that. Acts 22:16 is a good passage on that. "And now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins." 1 Peter 3:21 is another good passage on that. And so, we clean ourselves up, our whole body as it were. And in water, this is associated with the forgiveness of sins. In Romans 6:3 and 4, in case we miss it, Paul says, in baptism, you're buried with Him in the dead. In the dead. How do you ever get the benefit of the blood of Christ, Revelation 1:5, unless you are baptized into the death of Christ? And so Paul says, "Or know ye not that as many of us as were baptized into His death, we're baptized into the Lord's death." You get the effect of the blood when, as a believer and a penitent person, you're baptized into Christ. And so he talks about the whole body, as it were. And then your stripes. Have you washed your stripes? In Acts 16:33, Paul and Silas had undergone a good beating. You know, that had to be terribly humiliating in Philippi, Roman colony. And a false charge was raised against them, and they were beaten and cast into prison and then into an inner prison. And then finally there was an earthquake. At midnight there was a worship service. And then there was an earthquake. And then Paul spares the jailer from committing suicide. And from the brink of suicide, this jailer puts several things together. There's these unusual preachers I've got. These men are not normal criminals that I have to deal with. And there's this unusual earthquake. The doors are all open. The bands are loosed. And Paul says, "Do thyself no harm." He knows what the man's fixing to do, whether he can see him or not, I'm not sure. "Do thyself no harm. We are all here." You would assume prisoners would escape when given the chance. But in the providences of a most gracious and omnipotent God, everybody's in place. And so when Paul cries out, "Do thyself no harm, we are all here," then he sprang in. He was afraid. And he cries out, "What must I do to be saved?" That's the only time in the New Testament that question in that form appears. What must I do to be saved? And he put that together with all these other details. Maybe he had heard about their preaching in town. Who knows? And Paul, knowing of the man's complete ignorance, says, "Believe on the Lord, and thou shalt be saved, thou and thy house." That is, thou and thy house have to believe on the Lord. He's not saying your faith can stand for them. Believe, and thou shalt be saved, thou and thy. And then they preach the word of the Lord to him, because faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word. And then there's something that happens. And if you have Acts 16, I want you to look at that, at this with me. Because he says, "Believe on the Lord and thou shalt be saved." And then they spake the word. And then verse 33. "And he took them the same hour of the night." Now here's where our point comes in. "And washed their stripes. And was baptized, he and all his, immediately. And he brought them up into his house, and set food before them, and rejoiced greatly with all his house, having believed in God." Now that verb right there, "having believed," is singular. That is not a reference to his family. That's a reference to the jailer. It's singular, and it's perfect tense. And it means it's completed action with resulting condition that continues. Completed action with resulting condition that continues. He keeps on believing in God. His belief is completed having believed. He has been baptized into Christ. Galatians 3, 26 and 27. And now this is complete. And now he's able to rejoice. And as his family obeyed the gospel too, of course, they rejoice with him as well. But now my point on the outline is, have you washed your stripes? He washes the stripes of these men who've been beaten. Are you ready for the next fight? Are you ready for the next day? Are you ready for the next encounter with hostility or persecution or misrepresentation or hate or whatever it is? Members of the church have to be willing to put up with what the world throws at us under the providence of God. Our hearts bleed, of course, for our brethren over in the United Arab Emirates because of what they have had to put up with from false religion. I hate that men act like that. God does too. But under the auspices of an omniscient God, even in a democracy, whatever it might be, whatever God allows you to suffer, and Paul said, "They that live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution of some form, of some expression." The stripes get washed. Are you ready for the next stripes? Are you ready for the next affliction? Or what? Number 8. I'm coming to a close here. Have you washed the whole man? Let's just put it like that. When we're talking about Naaman, we're talking about the body. The body. But now have you washed the whole man? In 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 10. Verse 1. 2 Corinthians 7 and 1. This is an interesting expression, because you don't usually put these concepts in this combination. But in 2 Corinthians 7, 1, Paul says, "Having therefore these promises, beloved," the ones just discussed at the end of chapter 6, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit." Now usually in passages, you'll have a contrast drawn between flesh and spirit. But here he's putting them in combination as in need of cleansing. Your whole man, your spirit, your body, don't use... He's talking to members of the church. Don't use your spirit. Don't use your body in ways that defile it. You are God's man as a Christian. You are God's woman as a Christian. So clean up your act as you need to. He just told them, come out from the world. Don't be associating with the world. Don't be corrupting. Don't get corrupted by the world. Nobody has a right to uphold the false doctrine that false religion upholds. You have to be distinct. Come out, be ye separate, saith the Lord. I'll be your Father. I'll be your God. You'll be my children. But you've got to make the break with the world and with false religion. The whole man. And then finally, number 9. Have you washed your robes? Revelation 22 and verse 14. This book is just about completed. John will make this point. Blessed are they that have washed their robes, that they may have the right to come to the tree of life and may enter in by the gates into the city. Without are the dogs and the sorcerers and the fornicators and the murderers and the idolaters and everyone that loveth and maketh a lie. That covers all false religion, every distorted version of Christianity, and so-called Protestantism, Catholicism, cultism, whatever it is. Outside of the lies, inside is the truth. Who gets to come inside? Those that have already washed their robes. Back in chapter 3 and verse 4, Jesus had said through John, "Thou hast a few in Sardis that did not defile their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy." How about your robes? Are your robes clean? Are you ready for the coming of Christ? Are you ready for your death? Are you ready for judgment? Have you washed? If you're here this morning and not a Christian, we encourage you to come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, we encourage you to come home right now. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?